Climate change is a complex and multidimensional problem, and most certainly will not be cheap to resolve. But someone who has the answer about where we find the money is US economist Stephanie Kelton. Yes, welcome to this latest episode of Climate Conversations. I am your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people, and I pay my respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. Stephanie Kelton recently spoke in Melbourne, but if you didn't catch up with that event, you can hear her here, speaking at a TEDx event.
When things break, we have an opportunity. We can pick up the pieces and put them back together the old way, or we can look for better ways to build. COVID broke everything. It put a spotlight on the many deficits in our economy, in employment, education, healthcare, housing, and it showed how inequality made it all worse. Here in the US and around the world, governments did some extraordinary things. They sent money to people directly to help them buy food and pay rent. They provided free COVID testing and expanded healthcare to cover more of the population. They gave money to businesses to help keep them afloat while much of the economy was temporarily shut down. They offered debt relief to millions of people who borrowed money to go to college. They did all of this and more without raising taxes or having a prolonged battle over the usual question of how to pay for it. To me, this was exciting. And I'm an economist, so I don't say that a lot. But as someone who's been trying to change the way we think about deficits and government spending, I saw this as an opportunity to show why government budgets don't work like household budgets, why all of their red ink is really our black ink, and why our nation can afford to keep investing in the things we need even after spending trillions to fight the pandemic. For a while, it looked like the US and other countries were starting to break the mold on the old way of thinking about deficits and taxes. But now, here we are, just a handful of months after all of that bold action, and we're sliding back into our old habits of thought. Can we build affordable housing and fix crumbling infrastructure? Can we expand Medicare to include dental, vision, and hearing? Can we tackle our climate crisis? As Congress debates these questions, everyone is back to asking, how will you pay for it? It's the wrong question. In fact, the right questions don't involve money at all. Instead of worrying about where the financing will come from, we should be asking, are these things worth doing? And do we have the real resources, the people, the equipment, the raw materials, and the technology to do them? Will they make society better off? And do we have the political will to act? I'm one of a handful of economists who contributed to the body of academic scholarship known as MMT, or Modern Monetary Theory. MMT provides an accurate description of how a fiat currency, like the US dollar or the British pound, actually works. It reminds us that we're no longer on a gold standard, so finding the money to pay for the things we need is never an issue for countries like the US or the UK. If we're going to fix what's broken in our economy, we have to fix the way we think about the limits on government spending. Let me give you an example of the kind of broken gold standard thinking that still permeates our discourse. Back in 1983, the Prime Minister of Great Britain Margaret Thatcher said these words: "If the state wishes to spend more, it can do so only by borrowing your savings or by taxing you more. And it is no good thinking that someone else will pay. That someone else is you. There is no such thing as public money. There is only taxpayers' money." Maybe you've heard the contemporary version of Thatcher's dictum: "There is no magic money tree." It's just another way of saying that everything must be paid for and that the taxpayer is ultimately on the hook for whatever the government spends. It sounds worrying. As individuals, we know that when we borrow money to go to college, start a business, or buy a home, we're personally saddled with that debt. We have to find the money to pay it back. Taking on too much personal debt can lead to all sorts of problems. Even small businesses and large corporations have to walk a fine line when it comes to debt. But the federal government is fundamentally different. Unlike the rest of us, Congress never has to check the balance in its bank account to figure out whether it can afford to spend more. As the issuer of the currency, the federal government can never run out of money. It can afford to buy whatever is available and for sale in its own currency. Now, that might mean spending on roads and bridges, a military arsenal, or hospitals and schools. Finding the votes to pass a spending bill can be hard, but finding the money is never a problem. They just create it. So here's how it works. Whenever Congress and the president agree to spend more, the government's bank, the Federal Reserve, works with the rest of the financial system to get that money into our accounts. Everything's done electronically, so there's no physical printing of money involved. If you got a $1,400 check from the federal government earlier this year, or if your company received money to help cover payroll and other expenses, then you received some of the newly minted digital dollars that were created to support our economy. No taxpayers were involved in that process. It was all done using nothing more than a computer keyboard. So why are we hearing so much about the need to raise taxes to pay for infrastructure and make other investments in our economy? In a word, deficits. We've all been conditioned to worry about deficits. So lawmakers are looking for ways to spend more without adding to the deficit. That's what this whole pay-for game is about. Unfortunately, deficits have gotten a bad rap. They're almost always seen in a negative light. And I would like to change that. When we hear the word deficit, we probably think of a deficiency or shortfall. Okay, a deficit always sounds ominous. So when we hear that the federal government just ran a $3 trillion budget deficit, it can sound worrying, and it can even anger people. But there's another way to think about government deficits. Just as a 6 becomes a 9, when we view it from a different angle, a government deficit becomes a financial surplus when we look at it from another perspective. A deficit hawk might look at this picture and see nothing but a sea of worrying red ink. That's not how I look at it. Here's what I see. I see what's happening on the other side of the government's ledger. When the government spends more than it taxes away from us, it makes a financial contribution to some other part of the economy. Their red ink is our black ink. When you look at it this way, it becomes clear that every deficit is good for someone. The question is, for whom? And what are those deficits being used to accomplish? It matters how the money is spent and who ends up with the resulting surplus. Tax cuts that deliver huge windfalls for those at the top without sparking investment and opportunity for the rest of the population don't make good use of deficits. On the other hand, spending trillions to support the economy during the pandemic put the deficit to good use. We just had the shortest recession in US history. To me, that was fiscally responsible. Being responsible shouldn't mean running the government's finances like a household. Instead of trying to keep the deficit in check, Congress should be focused on keeping inflation in check. That's the real limit on spending. And it's the thing to watch out for if you're thinking about spending trillions on things like infrastructure, healthcare, and free college. Instead of asking, how will we pay for it? Congress should be asking, how will we resource it? To answer that question, think of people, factories, equipment, and raw materials like wood and iron. If we're going to build high-speed rail, fix crumbling infrastructure, and green our economy, then we'll need concrete, steel, and lumber. We'll need construction workers, architects, and engineers. We'll need companies that can fill thousands of orders for solar panels, EV charging stations, and electric school buses. If our economy has the productive capacity to quickly supply all of those things, then we can easily resource it. Or take healthcare or free college. Paying the bills to expand Medicare to include dental, vision, and hearing is easy. The challenge is making sure we have enough dentists, optometrists, and audiologists to treat everyone who needs care. And if you want to resource free college, then you need the faculty, the classrooms, and the dormitories to teach and house more students. In a full employment economy, all of the resources you need are, well, fully employed. There's no spare capacity anywhere in the system. So if the government suddenly tried to make all of these investments at once, it would quickly discover that it doesn't have the people or the building materials to do the work. To get the resources it needs, it would have to compete with the private sector, bidding up wages and prices. That would be inflationary, and it would be fiscally irresponsible. We are a long way from full employment. We have the resources we need to begin repairing our broken systems. But we have to believe it's possible. We can't let words like debt and deficits hold us back. With a better understanding of public money, where it comes from, and how it works, we can take aim at the many real deficits that are bearing down on us. In every crisis lies an opportunity. We can pick up the pieces and try to reassemble the fragile systems that were in place before the pandemic, or we can build anew, shaping our bountiful resources into the kind of world we want to live in, one that cares for our people and our planet. I truly hope we choose to be bold. Thank you.
Join me now as we listen to Professor Raymond Kaz presenting to the Royal Society of Victoria in September last year. The title for his presentation was Understanding Climate Change, All the Natural and Human Causes. Professor Kaz is the Emeritus Professor in Volcanology, School of Earth, Atmosphere and Environment, from Monash University. Here is his presentation.
I'm a volcanologist, and I've known for a long time that major volcanic eruptions can actually have significant impacts on weather immediately, and in some cases, climate on the longer term. And what I became interested in is trying to put that into the context of all the possible factors that actually could contribute to climate change. And so that's what I've developed here in this particular talk. We know that since the start of the Industrial Revolution, global temperature has increased about 1.2 degrees centigrade. Extreme weather and climate events are becoming more frequent. And we also know that a significant increase in the amount of human-made or anthropogenic greenhouse gases to the Earth's atmosphere. So what I want to evaluate is these various factors that contribute to increasing global temperature and climate change, and evaluate which ones are rapid or fast and which ones are slow, because we're looking for the ones that are fast. When the Earth first formed 4.5 billion years ago, the surface temperature of the Earth at that time must have been at least 1500 degrees centigrade. Now, the Earth's core temperature is still 6000 degrees. So there's clearly a temperature gradient from 6000 to 10 degrees centigrade average at the Earth's surface, which means that the Earth's interior will be progressively emitting heat, losing heat to the Earth's surface. If we look at that very low flux of heat compared with solar incoming radiation, we can say, look, it's really, really low. So we can eliminate slow and progressive heat loss from the Earth's interior as a cause for the global warming that's occurred in recent times. The flux of solar radiation to the Earth's atmosphere is that the intensity of that radiation actually cycles on an 11-year cycle. But those changes actually only account for a change in temperature of 0.1 to 0.4 degrees centigrade. And of course, after each peak of perhaps up to 4 degrees centigrade, the atmosphere loses that accumulated heat. So this diagram shows in yellow there this cyclicity of solar irradiance. And then compared with that is the rate at which temperature on the Earth's surface has been increasing. There's no parallelism between those cycles. So we can say reasonably confidently that that change in solar irradiance cannot really explain the relatively recent temperature increase that the Earth's atmosphere has experienced in the last few decades. So then we get to the orbital behaviour of the Earth around the Sun. The shape of the orbit, which is an ellipse, changes shape. Another orbital behaviour that changes is that we know that the Earth is spinning, but the axis of spin is inclined at an angle of between 21.5 and 24.5 degrees to the vertical. But that changes. And then in addition, that axis also wobbles. Now, in concert, those various changes define 100,000-year cycles of changing in the amounts of thermal radiation that come from the Sun, which therefore affect the global climate and temperature. There are two graphs here. There's a red one, which is temperature change, and there's a black one, which is carbon dioxide levels. And you can see there's a remarkable sympathy between increasing and decreasing temperature and increasing and decreasing carbon dioxide levels. Basically, the carbon dioxide levels shown on the left here were more or less a nice balance. The peak carbon dioxide level through this natural balance was about 300 parts per million. Except, right at the end there, this is the last 250 years, where basically the carbon dioxide level overshot 300, and now the latest measure in May this year is 424 parts per million. So then we go to asteroid impact. The Earth experienced a lot of asteroid impact during its early formation stages. Perhaps one of the best studied ones in terms of potential climate impacts is the Chicxulub asteroid, which impacted the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico just about 65 million years ago. There was an initial frictional heating, just lasting minutes perhaps. Then there was a basic interval of cooling. But also the location where that asteroid impacted the Earth's surface was dominated by limestone bedrock. And a lot of that stuff got ejected into the atmosphere, which then increased the carbon dioxide level of the atmosphere and caused an extended period of warming. So that's what asteroids can potentially do. But there has been no major asteroid to cause such effects over the last few million years. We can exclude this particular climate-changing cause as an explanation for the changing temperature of the globe in the last 250 years. And now to volcanic eruptions. There have been a number of studies to calculate what the annual flux of volcanic carbon dioxide is to the atmosphere. And the figure is generally up to about 260 million tonnes. But compare that with the amount of carbon dioxide that humans are releasing to the atmosphere per year, 40 billion tonnes. The input from volcanic gases is absolutely insignificant. Now, there have been no major carbon dioxide-producing volcanic eruptions in the last 250 years. So we can exclude carbon dioxide from a volcanic source as being a cause of the current global warming. Let's now look at sulfur dioxide. It reacts with a number of agents in the atmosphere to form these droplets of sulfuric acid. And these reflect solar radiation back to space. So in summary, only super eruptions are capable of causing rapid, substantial climate change. There are none that really affect global climate. We're involving the emission of a lot of carbon dioxide. Sulfur dioxide-rich eruptions can, in fact, produce a lot of global cooling. None of them can explain the current heating that we're experiencing. So then we go to biological processes. So some are carbon dioxide absorbing, and these include photosynthesis. There are also carbon dioxide producing processes in the biosphere. Respiration, obviously, is a really important one from animals and plants. And then, of course, there's the decay of organic matter. These changes, however, in carbon dioxide levels through biospheric processes are reasonably slow. We can say that apart from deforestation in the last 250 years, these other processes probably haven't contributed to the very rapid temperature rise that we've experienced. So then we go to the dynamics of the Earth's atmosphere and the ocean. If we just took a simple globe, we know that the poles are cold, the equators are hot, and that should set up a simple north to south and south to north convection system that redistributes heat over the Earth's surface. Now, the thing that stops that single, simple convective cell redistribution of thermal energy is the fact that the Earth is rotating. This is a nice theoretical model, but it presumes that the Earth has no continents. But now we have the continents, and of course, what we know is that these latitudinal oceanic currents actually get deflected by the margins of the continents. And this is the Gulf Stream here in the Atlantic. And it gets deflected along the eastern margin of North America and then along the eastern margin of Greenland and reaches the Arctic Ocean. It delivers warm tropical waters to those high latitudes, and that increases the evaporation rate of seawater in the poles, which then, of course, leads to a lot of water moisture in the atmosphere. And because of the low temperature of the atmosphere, that very quickly induces condensation and precipitation as snow, which then begins to build up snowfields and ice sheets in those polar regions. That redistribution of thermal energy from the tropics is a really important part of that story. That's all well and good, but have the continents always been in their current position? And the answer is no. Could that actually cause climate change? And the answer would be yes, if the continents are drifting across latitudes in north-south directions, okay? And if you want to calculate what the temperature effect of that northward displacement is, it amounts to 0.00002.9 degrees centigrade. So our climate here in Melbourne is not going to change significantly through that as a factor. A question then obviously arises, did the Earth experience climate change in the past? The answer is yes. How do we know? Because we can actually measure past temperatures using a geochemical proxy. And the geochemical proxy that is used is the ratio of the oxygen isotope 18 to the oxygen isotope 16. We can actually collect fossils of different ages back in the past, and we can analyse their calcium carbonate skeletons, separating out the oxygen and subjecting that to delta 18 analyses. The top image there shows over 57,000 delta 18 analyses. The analyses span from just over 500 million years through to the present day. And the calculations of what the temperatures might have been in the past are on this second diagram there. These different graphs reflect different possible temperatures, and they're based on using different models that the geochemists use. Now, which one is correct is irrelevant. What is important here is that they all have the same shapes. CO2 and temperature change naturally in a state of balance until 250 years ago. And then, in the last 250 years, everything has skyrocketed. How can we really be sure that it is all anthropogenic carbon dioxide and not just natural carbon dioxide? There are three isotopes of carbon, 12, 13 and 14. When vegetation material or fossil vegetation material such as coal, gas and oil are burnt, it's large volumes of carbon-12 that are released into the atmosphere. And carbon-12 relative to fairly static levels of carbon-13. So basically, when we combust fossil fuels, we're lowering the ratio of carbon-13 to carbon-12. Now, what that tells us is that the rise of carbon dioxide in the last 50, 70 years, and certainly in the last 150 to 250 years, is almost entirely due to the release of anthropogenic gases. Measurement of carbon dioxide levels, methane, nitrous oxide, particularly from ice cores over the last few hundred years, have shown the following trends. Carbon dioxide going up and down a bit, up and down a bit, but then since the start of the Industrial Revolution, skyrocketing. Similarly with methane, skyrocketing. And then with nitrous oxide, again, exactly the same. Here's the temperature increase, particularly from the 1950s onwards today, which correspond basically with the automobile explosion. Temperature has increased and accelerated at extreme rates. I think we can unequivocally attribute rising global temperatures in the last 250 years to the burning of fossil fuels and extraction of cement and other commodities. There is value in greenhouse gases because they moderate, they mediate heat loss, heat gain, etc., from the various sources that we've discussed. It's just identifying the Goldilocks balance that allows us to have some control. And there is one way in which we control it, and that's through anthropogenic gas release and emissions.
Next, we have a story from the Melbourne Age, which talks about former New South Wales Energy Minister Matt Keane resigning from a ginger group which was founded to promote action on climate change. The headline of the story is Split Inside Conservative Green Group Over New Nuclear Agenda. The story is written by Nick O'Malley, and you'll find a link for that in the show notes.
Former New South Wales Energy Minister Matt Keane has resigned from a ginger group founded to promote action on climate change within the coalition over what he says is a shift away from its original principles to become a nuclear advocacy organisation. Keane says the Coalition for Conservation's rhetoric on nuclear energy has shifted since the former president of the Nationals, Larry Anthony, whose lobbying firm SAS has represented fossil fuel companies, joined the organisation as chair, and the energy millionaire Trevor Street Baker came on as a member of its advisory board. It went from an organisation focused on a diverse range of clean energy solutions to an organisation singularly focused on nuclear energy, Keane told this masthead. The group's chief executive officer and founder Christina Talico said she regretted Keane's decision to step down as an ambassador but rejected his view that its advocacy for nuclear undermined its conservation mission. It's important to recognise that many conservative individuals and organisations worldwide, including those in the US, Canada, and the UK, support nuclear energy as a means to reduce our footprint on nature. To suggest otherwise is simply absurd, Talico said in a statement. She said the Coalition for Conservation operates independently of any funding from nuclear suppliers or the nuclear industry. We make no apologies for our efforts in seeking alternative approaches to minimize environmental impact and will continue to support behind-the-meter solar, small grids, and good renewable projects that are placed in the right sites, avoiding farming and forest land destruction as well as nuclear as part of the transition. Keane launched the organization at a function in 2016 on behalf of Talico and remained actively involved as the group engaged with a range of international conservative political figures who advocated for action on climate. Australian Conservation Foundation Chief Executive Kelly O'Shaughnessy said the ACF had supported the Coalition for Conservation when it was founded and helped it set up some of its early conferences, but it opposes the group's shift towards nuclear and no longer has anything to do with it. O'Shaughnessy said it was the foundation's view that the small modular reactors being advanced by the organisation are decades away from commercial deployment, and advocating for them delays the transition to renewable energy. The group has also lost the support of Environmental Leadership Australia. At its outset, the group appeared to have only loose ties with senior members of the federal coalition, but since it started advocating for nuclear and opposing renewables, its standing appears to have increased. Talico travelled to the Dubai climate talks late last year with seven coalition MPs, including energy spokesman Ted O'Brien, Bridget McKenzie, Andrew Bragg, Pera Davey, Dean Smith and Kevin Hogan. Talico said the MPs' travel was paid for by the Coalition for Conservation. While in Dubai, O'Brien appeared at a side event hosted by the group and the World Nuclear Association and gave a speech endorsing nuclear energy for Australia. In February, Talico was part of another delegation that included O'Brien, which travelled to Canada to visit Ontario Power Generation. Coalition figures often cite Ontario as a state that is successfully integrating nuclear energy into its power system, but OPG is also a business seeking to export its technology. The company's head of new nuclear growth, Gary Rose, posted on LinkedIn in February, "Today we had an opportunity to share with a delegation from Australia information regarding OPG's new nuclear, SMR program. The world is watching the great things that are happening here in Ontario." Last year Rose told a podcast, "My job is to look at what other nuclear opportunities exist. We're also supporting new nuclear deployment in places like Poland, Estonia and a number of other discussions going on with a number of different countries like Australia, Czech Republic and others."
It's important that I make it clear right from the outset that I in no way support nuclear power. That's nuclear energy. No way. The old reporter in me rises up and says, "You have to present the other side of the argument." So here it is. It's from Decouple Media. This episode from Decouple Media presents an argument by the VP of New Nuclear Growth at Ontario Power Generation, Gary Rose. Here it is now. Well, here is the start now, and you'll find a link to the entire presentation in the show notes.
Welcome back to Decouple. Today I'm joined by Gary Rose, who is VP of New Nuclear Growth at OPG. Gary, a very warm welcome to Decouple.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here today. Looking forward to the discussion.
It's been a long time coming. I think we met for the first time at COP 20. I always get the numbers mixed up. COP 27 in Egypt. And we've been kind of circling each other. So glad to finally make this happen. You gave us a fantastic tour of the Darlington mock-up. And today we're definitely going to be focusing in part on the refurbishment program because it is my thesis, and I'm be interested to see if you share it, that Ontario is the best equipped jurisdiction in the Western world for the deployment of new nuclear. I'm not sure if you agree or not, but we'll get into that. So your career, I mean, that was a very brief intro, VP New Nuclear Growth. You've been, I think, probably at Ontario Hydro because that's what it was before it turned into OPG, but you've been there, 35 years? So just take a minute or two to walk us through your career path and sort of some of the things you've been involved with before getting into this VP New Nuclear Growth thing.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Yeah, 35 years at Ontario Hydro OPG. We'll call it OPG from this point forward. I was I did two semesters of food and beverage management at college and decided I did not want to work every Friday and Saturday night for the rest of my life. So ended up at OPG in 1988 as a clerk typist.
Wow.
I've had a fantastic time at OPG, great company to work for. It really gave me opportunities to grow. First 5 years, I was in energy management. Ironically enough, back then, I was working to promote energy efficiency, for the purposes of not building new nuclear plants. That was the goal. Awesome. So it's kind of ironic where my career has come to at this point, where I'm out there promoting new nuclear growth. And to your earlier point, I think we are certainly ready and the best equipped to execute new nuclear projects in the future here in Ontario. So what happened in the middle of all that? 1993, declared surplus when we stopped the energy management program, ended up in corporate finance, knew nothing about finance, decided I better go back to school, did my commerce degree, my accounting designation, worked in corporate accounting, got involved in projects in preparation for Y2K, thought I better learn something about projects, went and did my project management professional certification at Durham College, which I am now the chairman of the board at Durham College, which is a nice full circle as well. Wow. So, you know, first half of my career really in finance. And I think that defines me. I think people would conclude that my bias is cost, right? To me, it's all about how much does it cost and what are the value proposition of spending said money, so to speak.
Right.
In the early 2000s, I moved to Pickering. I was on the Pickering Return to Service Project, where I learned an incredible amount in concepts like earned value management, project controls, construction management. That was my job. I was in this intersection of finance and project controls. And it was really a unique time because, finance is all about how much money I've spent against a budget. Project controls is how much work have I done against that budget. So the ability to measure day-to-day work really changed my outlook on things. So I spent a few years in Pickering a return to service. Of course, we decided not to proceed to restart units, Pickering units 2 and 3.
Yeah.
I ended up in our nuclear project and modifications organization, which does modification-based projects. I led a project called Cost and Schedule Improvement Project, which was all about getting much timelier cost and schedule information to be able to evaluate performance of project delivery. You couldn't wait till the invoice showed up to understand where the project was at. You needed to know where the project was at real time so you could take real time actions and make real time decisions. So that has been really instrumental to what we're going to talk about today. 2008, I shifted to the Darlington Refurbishment Program. I was the first executive on that team that has actually been here through the total duration of Unit 2.
And the refurbs haven't started until, I'm actually not sure on the dates, but 2008, that's a long time before we started actually doing the work, right?
In 2008, it was really, we were asked to do a feasibility assessment on the decision to refurbish or not to refurbish both Pickering and Darlington at that point.
Right, okay.
So I was involved in that business case. In 2009, we decided to proceed with the refurbishment of Darlington. So we sanctioned the project and put a project charter in place. I was ultimately the vice president of project planning and project controls. So I was accountable to establish the baseline for how we would measure performance on the project. That culminated in what we call a release quality estimate in 2015 that we took to our board and to our shareholder for approval of a $12.8 billion project. So we set a cost and schedule baseline in 2015 at this time of release quality estimate. We took that to the Ontario Energy Board and had it evaluated there. And that baseline is how we're measuring our performance. We'll talk about how that performance looks
for sure.
And how it is that we were able to stay on that baseline. The current refurbishment program at Darlington is ahead of schedule and on budget, which is not said too often in the same sentence as nuclear.
Right.
So we certainly have a very positive story to tell. And you're right. We spent 7 to 8 years planning this project. And, my adage is planning doesn't guarantee success, but lack of planning guarantees failure. And I truly, truly believe that. So it's planning. You need to plan, and then you have to have meticulous execution against that plan. So that's a little bit of the career summary. I then transitioned over the last couple of years to support the decisions with respect to the decision to proceed with the DNNP, the Darlington New Nuclear Project, and the selection of the General GE Hitachi BWRX 300 project, which was transitioned over to the Enterprise Projects Organization here at OPG. And I've transitioned to be the Vice President of New Nuclear Growth, where my job is to look at what other nuclear opportunities exist in Ontario, how do we approach those projects, and of course we support other provinces in the Pan-Canadian SMR approach, and through a subsidiary called Laurentis Energy Partners, we're also supporting new nuclear deployment in places like Poland, Estonia, and a number of other discussions going on with a number of different countries like Australia, Czech Republic, and others.
I hope you'll notice that Gary mentioned Australia just at the end there, and you'll find a link for the entire clip in the show notes. I had something of a treat yesterday, and yesterday was Friday, April 5, when Peter Foote, the main man at Foote Waste, picked me up in his all-electric garbage truck. Yes, all-electric. What a wonderful, handsome truck. Foote Waste is Shepparton-based, and the Volvo truck, the Volvo demonstration truck, is here for at least a month to allow Peter and his team to decide whether or not or how they will fit it into their processes. As I said, it's a handsome truck. It has all the modern conveniences, but it's electric. It's so quiet that people simply can't hear it. It's a huge truck, or it has all the required flashing lights, but people simply don't hear it. In fact, we had one pedestrian about to step into the roadway in front of the truck, and Peter had to brake rather quickly to ensure there wasn't a collision. As electric vehicles become more common on our roads, people are going to have to learn that they cannot survive simply by the hearing. They're going to have to look as well. When I first became aware of the climate crisis in the early 2000s, I figured that if you just gave people information, that's all you would need to do, because once they knew what was going on, they would react and they would behave appropriately. How wrong I was. But I'm not alone. Even the people at Climate One, that well-recognized podcast and news service, have experienced exactly the same problems. Host Greg Dalton and Ariana Brocious talk about that dilemma. Here's the intro to one of their latest podcasts where they talk about exactly that problem. And you'll find a link to the podcast in the show notes.
I'm Greg Dalton.
I'm Ariana Brocious.
And this is Climate One. As media hosts, we like to think that more information equals more action. But it turns out the way we behave is more complicated than that.
Right. The way we convey information really matters, and who the storyteller is. And climate, in particular, is a difficult and complicated story to tell. It's multifaceted. It has a whole bunch of implications.
Right. It's so big, it's hard for us to see. It doesn't have a villain with a human face. That's why I so admire the work of Elizabeth Kolber. I read her book, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, back in 2006. She goes to far-flung places and witnesses the warning signs of climate change. In fact, that book is a huge part of what motivated me to create Climate One in the first place. It was such a compelling read for me.
And 20 years later, she's still at it. She's been covering climate for decades, and I always look forward to reading her work in The New Yorker because I know that it's going to be a compelling, insightful, and well-written story that takes me somewhere and also gives me a real dose of reality about our climate present. In her new book, H is for Hope, Climate Change from A to Z, Colbert tries a different approach to climate storytelling.
Right. It's written in bite-sized vignettes. You can jump into this point or that point, this letter, that letter. Though I will say it's not entirely hopeful.
Yeah, because she's a realist and a journalist, and she's been covering climate for so long, she knows the score. That's why I was so excited to talk with her for this week's show. And I wanted to start the conversation by her taking us back to her first trip to a weather station in Greenland in the early 2000s.
Well, it's really as close as you can get, I think, without leaving planet Earth to being on another planet. It's a very other, sort of otherworldly experience. If you're actually on the top of the ice sheet, it's just white snow in all directions, just this vast expanse of white. If you're sort of closer to the edge of the ice sheet, then it's a little bit more nerve-wracking, I suppose, because there are crevasses and all sorts of features to the ice. They're beautiful. They can be very beautiful. There can be these huge melt streams that are this fantastic color blue, and these moulins, which are these just holes that develop in the ice where ice water just drops many, many thousands of feet. But being near one, and I have been very near one, is a bit nerve-wracking.
I mean, I'm curious, you've been back several times since that first trip. What changes have you observed? Have you seen sort of with your own eyes the impacts of climate change?
Well, I don't want to, you know, say that I've seen with my own eyes because I'm not a native Greenlander, but the Greenlanders who you speak to will tell you there are immense changes that they have seen in the course of, you know, just the last couple of decades. And I'll give you one example. There's a town called Ilulissat, which is on Greenland's west coast, and it's at the outlet of this large ice stream where these huge icebergs break off, fantastically beautiful. And two things that people in that town have noticed. First off, that the icebergs, which are still quite huge, have gotten smaller over time. Their elevation has just dropped, so their size has dropped. And secondly, this bay, this huge bay, it's called Disko Bay, used to freeze over in the winter, and people ran dog sleds over it. And now it doesn't freeze. And so that's a huge, huge change, as you can imagine.
Well, you personally, like many of us, have begun to witness some of these changes in your own neck of the woods. What have you seen from your home in terms of changing impacts, changing seasons?
Well, anyone, you know, who's lived pretty much anywhere for a couple decades now, or even a couple of years, it sometimes seems, can see big changes. What I've seen, you know, in the Berkshires, I live in Western Massachusetts in an area that where we have a lot of ski resorts. They're having, you know, tremendous trouble because the snow just, it's the season even of making snow. So a lot of these snow resorts used to run on natural snow, which would be really impossible these days. And even the window for making snow has really crunched down to a very small window. The maple sugaring is a big, I don't want to say it's a big industry, but it's a lot of people maple sugar where I live. That mm-hmm. window where you need these freezing nights and warmer days, there's always a pretty small window for sugaring, but now it's just moved up so that it happens now. You have, you know, April, and now it's happening, can happen in the end of February this year. So people have seen really, really big changes in seasonality. And that's just true everywhere.
Yeah, we've been hearing those stories on the show for the last several years, people really beginning to kind of understand that this isn't happening in the future, it's happening right now. You're a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, and lately you've written about rising sea temperatures, unprecedented natural disasters like Hurricane Otis, and the ecological consequences of extractive industries. And to be totally frank, a lot of your reporting is a harsh dose of reality for where we are in this climate moment. And I'm curious how you hope your work lands with readers.
Well, I guess I'd say I subscribe to a pretty old-fashioned view of journalism, which is that the journalist's job is really to report on what's going on. And his or her job is not to tell you how to feel about it or not to even think about that, really. It's just to report the facts to the best of their ability. And so I guess that's what I'm reporting on, the facts to the best of my ability.
Mm-hmm. Climate One co-host Greg Dalton interviewed you on this show back in 2017. You said that solving this problem, climate disruption, climate change, is above your pay grade, and that you hope to inspire people to think about it, but you can't take responsibility for what they do with the information. We had a recent episode where we discussed this idea of a information deficit model of climate communication and how it may be insufficient since we've tried it for the last however many years and haven't seen a significant change in how people are necessarily responding to or perceiving of the problem. So at this point in your career, are you still convinced that that's the best path forward?
Well, I think there are all sorts of ways to communicate climate change. I mean, there should be, you know, advertising campaigns. There should be a lot of other things going on. But I think as a journalist, I mean, once again, I just don't know. I don't have the ability. I don't have the resources, to be honest, to, you know, test drive messages to go out there and say, well, would this story work? Would that story work? You know, we're just not equipped to do that. We're, you know, sort of barely equipped at this point to get the information out. And you know, the information deficit model, once again, that's being challenged on all fronts, and not to get into contemporary politics, but there's so many forces muddying the message these days for many times, often highly motivated reasons. It's not entirely clear to me that we have adequately tested the information deficit model because there's still a lot of information deficit. But even if I had, you know, very clear evidence that that was not the way to communicate this message to motivate action, I still wouldn't have means to come up with a different way to do journalism. And, You know, I still think there's a function for the truth, even if the truth is not what is going to get us from A to B.
Yeah, I echo that. There's definitely a role for the truth.
Yeah, it's something we can all, I hope, get behind, but I'm not sure. Yeah.
I want to get into your new book, H is for Hope. This is an abecedary, which is, you know, each letter stands for a word. It's a totally different format than your other climate books, which are longer journeys made by following scientists around. This one is a short collection of essays on different aspects of the climate crisis that connect to each other in a really nice, longer narrative. So I'm curious why you took this format that differs so much from some of your past work.
Well, I was really trying to do a few things simultaneously, and one of which was to sort of reanimate this story. I do think there's a way that people, you know, sort of turn away from climate stories. They feel like they've read them before. What is there new to say? So sort of kind of break that story open and catch people off guard a little bit, I guess. But the other inspiration for it was that, you know, climate change is just such a huge story. It's not one story. If you follow even a really great, important climate change story to its end, you've only told one strand of this almost infinitely stranded story. And so I wanted to try to bring more of those strands together. And this seemed like a way to do that.
Yes, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks for your company. It's been so great to have you along. Now, I'd love you to follow this podcast, because if you do that, you'll be alerted every time I publish a new episode. Beyond that, put this on your network, share it with your friends, let people know what's happening with the climate crisis, because the more people know, the more they can act and behave appropriately. Also, I'd love to have your voice on this podcast, so you can contact me via email at r.mclean7@icloud.com. Yes, I want to hear from you. I want your voice on this podcast. I want to know what you think about the podcast, what you think about the climate crisis. I can contact you via phone, or we can speak over Zoom. Either way, please contact me. Importantly, I'd like to know what you think about this podcast, so please contact me at that aforementioned email address. Let me know, good or bad, don't hold back. Please tell me. And so, until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind. For everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Now take care and stay safe.